Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 226, 226. And we were in the middle of the Song of Moses last time. We'll continue from verse 10, chapter 15, where Moses says, speaking about the crossing of the Red Sea, and that is all singing with all of Israel about the miracle that God just performed here, an awesome miracle. And he says in verse 10, "You did blow with your wind, and the sea covered them. They sunk as lead in the mighty waters." And it's very interesting that long time after that, a descendant of the children of Israel, of King David, Queen Elizabeth, during the days of the Spanish Armada, when they constantly were fighting back and forth with the Spanish monarchy and the peoples, and in essence over the preeminence and having the dominion over the birthright, though they didn't know it, obviously, in both cases they lost their identity, they were not as aware as they should have been of what is really happening here. But here, God, again, you know, he was fighting on behalf of his people Israel and against a twin brother of Israel, that is, brother Esau, brother Edom. And ironically, the first one where it happened, in this case, the drowning of the Egyptian army and all the chariots and everything that they brought with them, was along what later on became known as the Red Sea, the Sea of Edom. Well, these people of Edom, some of them migrated to Spain anciently, and here they're fighting with the children of Israel, and they're sending their armada, and in essence, their intent was, and had God not destroyed them, they probably would have been more successful in doing what they wanted. They, in essence, wanted to destroy the British people. It was a jihad, you might say, in those days, and on their part, not only dominion over that land, but you know, they wanted destruction of many of those people, and they would have massacred probably an awful lot of them. They were on the path of genocide of the people of Israel, where God let them know what he thought about it. And so Queen Elizabeth, realizing that, knowing the Bible, knowing the Song of Moses, that's exactly the statement that she made at that point when she received information that the Spanish Armada drowned. She knew who did it. And so she said, "You did blow with your wind, and the sea covered them. They sunk as lead in the mighty waters." And that was the Canaan, or the channel, the British channel. And this is what God had done anciently, and he had done many things likewise for his people in several, you know, different ages. God never forsook his people, no matter where they were, and delivered them from their enemies. Verse 11, "Who is like unto you, O Eternal, among the mighty?" By Elim, you know, the mighty is, means Elim in Hebrew. "Mi kamocha by Elim, Yehovah." And it's interesting, this statement was often used by the pagans at a coronation ceremony. And in those days, obviously, because pagan leaders were also considered as deities, this is the statement that they would make before them, you know. "Who is like unto you, O Great One, or Holy One," whatever it may be, whatever, you know, deity they worshipped, who was really a man, and there is none other Elim like you. And so the word Elim here is like Elohim, it's the same word. And so who is like you? In other words, you are true Elohim, all the others are not. So you the Eternal, you Yehovah, there is none like you among all the other Elohim. That's why God says, don't make other Elohim beside me. There is only one. And Elohim means deity. You see? And that's what it means. Now, since all the others are not really real, therefore there is only one that was dealing with human beings, one Elohim. All the rest were fake. And so he says, "Who is like unto you, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders?" And in English, you really miss an awful lot of the poetry of the fire that is in this poem. It's very powerful in Hebrew. In English, you know, just like translating Shakespeare into Chinese, and what do you end up with? Well, that's exactly here. And there is no way to explain to you and to convey to non-Hebrew speakers the poetry of this wonderful poem that God himself inspired and placed on the lips of every Israelite at that generation. Only God, you know, with that kind of spirit can produce that. People think that Moses is the one that did it. He did not do it. No more than David wrote all the Psalms on his own. You see, it was the Spirit of God speaking through them. And that's how the servants of God prophesied. That means praise God, you see, with words that were inspired directly by God himself. So he is the absolute poet, and they are, in essence, just the mouthpiece of that. And that's the reason why the spirit of prophecy is also applicable not only to telling you or foretelling about events to happen, but much of the spirit of prophecy had to do with the praises that people gave God. And that was a part also of the divine service. And that's the reason why God wanted to be praised with words that he himself inspired by his spirit, and the people that served him, prophets, be it David, Moses, anybody else. And Moses also had some psalms in the book of Psalms. The Jews claim that the psalm, beginning with Psalm 19, and the other nine, that means 10 of them, have been actually composed by Moses. I don't know if it's true, but that's a tradition there. But all these people of God and all the prayers of God were also generally done under the inspiration, guidance, and direction of the Holy Spirit. And that became a part of the divine service, and that's the reason why David basically made it very plain that what you sing at the temple are compositions, be it music or be it the words that have been inspired by God. You see? And that's why later on Paul would say about the people of the Corinthians who learned that from the synagogue. You see? And who knew that God still is inspiring his people? And so he told others, do not despise the spirit of prophesying. You know, when God chooses to prophesy through this person or that person, and those words basically would be words of praise. And that's in essence what you see here. God literally put the spirit of prophecy, that is, of praising God, exalting God, in the mouth of every single being that was there, beginning with Moses and all the rest of the children of Israel, adults and youngs. And so that's what we see here. And unfortunately, you know, it's impossible to convey it in English unless you learn the language itself. And so in verse 12, we read, you stretch out your hand and the earth swallowed them. And you, in your love, has led the people, not in anger or hatred, you know, as they constantly accuse God and Moses, you know, you didn't love us, and therefore you wanted to kill us here. No. Everything that he had done there, even when they went through difficult situations in the wilderness, where God let only tell them, I did it all that because I wanted to try and test you to see whether you would obey me or not. And so when we go through a lot of difficult situations in life, trials, tribulation, afflictions, as horrible as they may be, they could be all the way up to death. It is the love of God that is doing it, not the anger or the hatred of God. And many of us do not see it for what it is. And so many rebel against it. And they say, well, if God is love, he wouldn't do that. Well, we don't decide for him what he's going to do, what he's not. To begin with, people who speak like that obviously do not know God as they should. Pain is the one that is speaking through them, not the Spirit of God. Not understanding. And so he says, you in your love has led the people that you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. So from the time and the moment that he took them out of Egypt and all the wanderings in the wilderness, and all the times where there was not enough water and they were all thirsty and the kids were yelling and crying and the animals were doing likewise and people were angry and upset and all that, that was the love of God leading them through that. The chastening of God is love, and people don't understand that. They think love means only, you know, good things. And you know how, you know, parents understand that very well. Their children are that way. You do all kind of good things for them. They're happy with you. As soon as you withhold something from them, or you tell them to do something they don't like to do, you know, even brushing your teeth sometimes, and you know, they complain about it, and all kind of things like that, clean up your mess, whatever it may be, they think you hate them. They literally think you hate them. You don't like them. They get angry and furious. Well, that's a mind with that is void of the Spirit of God. That has no eyesight to see what God is doing or what parents are doing. And that's why we behave that way. So, you know, we have to learn to see that. When we see trials, to see the guiding hand of God in it, which is a loving hand, you see? And therefore, with that, we make it all the way to the habitation, the holy habitation. For us, it's the kingdom, you see? Or on a daily basis, you know, the next step, where God delivers us out of the water or whatever it may be. And this is what Moses is saying. And that's what God is inspiring to be written, and those are things that are as admonitions for us, to understand that. That's how we learn to enter the mind of God. That's how we begin to get to know him even better, and then to love him, and hunger for him, ache for him, you know, and drink of his spirit, of his truth, eat his flesh, drink his blood, as Christ would put it, and we become like him. And sort of, you know, we become him. Same nature, same mind, and then we all become one. And then God will become one, you see? That's the oneness that God speaks about, and people never understood it. A lot of people still don't to this very day, and many in our midst are losing the information they had to begin with. And now they go back to their old ways. The oneness of God is when God becomes one in us and through us, and when we all have the same nature and mind. Does not mean numerically in terms of 1, 2, 3. Speaking about spiritual unity. And when God the Father ultimately would descend with heaven in Jerusalem and all his sons and daughters become spirit beings, then God will be all and in all, and in that day there is going to be only one God. But what does it mean, one God? One deity. You see? That's one made of many. In other words, one in spirit, in truth, in nature, character, and so forth. And verse 14, God inspires Moses here, again, and all of Israel, to say these things. The peoples have heard, they tremble, pangs have taken hold on the inhabitants of Philistia, or Pleshet, in Hebrew, and Pleshet was only the territory where the Philistines dwelt. Doesn't mean, you know, the entirety of the land. That's something that happened in 137 A.D. by the children of, that is, the Romans. And people just attribute that, and especially scholars, because they began to call it, after that, you know, centuries after that, it became accepted that the land is called Palestine, so they began to apply it retroactively all the way down to the days of Moses and before that. You know, Abraham, they say, he left Babylon and came to Palestine. And a lot of people in our midst are still using this terminology today, which is absolute ignorance. And when you understand the spiritual context behind it, you realize that it's even not only ignorance, but blasphemy of God himself. The God of Israel is not the God of Palestine, he's the God of Israel. He's the God of the overcomers, not the invaders. You see, there is a person that invaded the kingdom of God, and Christ, you know, looked at him and it says, you know, you don't have the right garment. What are you doing here? He threw him out. There are no invaders in the kingdom of God, and there is no Palestine in the vocabulary of God either. And so he says, you know, the inhabitants of Pleshet in Hebrew, Philistia, translated later on, God to begin with prevented his people from going up there, nearing their territory, because they were men of war. But they too were scared to death when they heard it. They trembled. Everybody heard about it. And verse 15, then were the chiefs of Edom afraid. The mighty men of Moab trembled, or trembling, taking hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan, see, not Palestine, all inhabitants of Canaan, the Canaanites, and there were many tribes of them, many peoples, are melted away. And God wanted that through his acts for all nations of the earth. And this knowledge traveled throughout the entirety of the world at the time, which wasn't that big anyway. And everybody on the face of the earth knew the God of Israel. And many traveled from far away to come and see the God of Israel and to worship the God of Israel, like, you know, the eunuch from Ethiopia. But they came from all over the place. And we don't know how many became a part of the people of Israel by religion, or even just literally came and remained with them as the strangers that became a part of the people. Verse 17, you bring them in and planted them in the mountain of your inheritance. That is, in the kingdom, your kingdom, and the land of Canaan became the kingdom of God, kingdom of Israel, not the kingdom of Palestine. And that became the holy mountain and the inheritance of God and the land of the Lord, all those names that were given to that. And so, you know, the more you understand that, and the more you begin to realize that, well, what does it mean when people call the land of God the inheritance of God, the holy mountain of God, Palestine, the land of the invaders? You see, that's a spiritual problem that many people still have to this very day. And whether they like to admit it or not, whether they realize it or not, it is a streak of Jewish feelings. Lodged deeply in their heart, and they cannot, you know, spew it out. One of these days they're going to have to do it the hard way. They don't do it now. And so Moses says, the place, that is the place of the Lord, your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for you to dwell in. God dwells in that land. God, you see, is the God of Israel. God dwells in that land. Don't blaspheme the land of God. Don't blaspheme the place of his habitation, his holy mountain, his inheritance. People are doing it in ignorance. They shouldn't do that, because God is not mocked, and he's not going to take it lightly, or, you know, with people that mock him and have contempt for him. Because when you have contempt for the name of his land, you have contempt for him directly, whether you like, you know, realize it or not. You know, got to wake up sometimes. Come out of Babylon. So he says, that's your sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. You see, with his own hands, he's established that place. It is his sanctuary. It is his habitation. Not only his sanctuary now. Well, he brings the children of Israel there, but it's going to be his eternal sanctuary with heaven and Jerusalem descending there. Why would he want to call that place Palestine? What spirit is moving people to say that? Now, let's realize that. And that'd be like Jesus Christ had to tell James and John, you know not of what manner of spirit you are. When you do things like that, or think of things like that, or when we say things like that. Eh? Verse 18, the Lord shall reign forever and ever, and he reigns in the midst of his people, and obviously over the whole earth. But that's his headquarters. Let's, you know, have respect for God and his place and his people and his names and the names that he gave to the land. Verse 19, for the horses of Pharaoh went in with his chariots and with his horsemen into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the children of Israel walked on dry land. Now this is another part of the poem. Now this is just recounting history, so to speak. Verse 19. But the children of Israel walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dances. And Miriam sang unto them. Now this was a part of the spirit of prophecy, and God now is putting it in the mouth of Miriam and the women that went after her. And before that you read, then sang Moses and all the sons of Israel. And now you read about the women joining in. So maybe the women were not singing with the song of Moses, maybe they were, but whichever it may be, both are to praise God, and God put the spirit of prophecy in both men and women. And he made it very plain here. So she's prophesying, and they are also prophesying with her. And so she said, sing you to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider has he thrown into the sea. And what other things she said, we don't know. But God, again, inspired her by the Spirit, and she began to prophesy, and all the women that prophesied with her. With, you know, timbrels and dances and all that, and some people don't realize that. That was a part of the divine service that was also in the temple. Some people think that, you know, people went to the temple, you know, the concept that they have today for what it means to go to synagogue or church, and it's not it at all. This was a part of the divine service, and also, and everything was geared toward God. You see, what happened to us, we departed so far away from it, from the divine service, from the way to worship God, and we invented our own things, and we think they are holy, and they are acceptable before God, and pleasing in his sight, and they all come and listen to a man, and man is the center of that service, and not God. While the bride of God, instead of singing and dancing, you know, before God, with timbrels as he commanded us, as we went through it earlier with the section of the divine service, and this part of the divine service, we actually made it a separate series, but it is, you know, for those who are interested, it's there. And we had several lessons there on the same subject, the divine series. And so if you'll go through that, you'll get an understanding there of what the divine worship is all about, that Paul speaks about, that the divine worship, you know, the service of God was committed unto the people of Israel, the people of Judah in specific, because the others just went their own way. And when they were singing and dancing, you know, before deities, those were foreign deities, but the children of Israel, in spite of all their problems in terms of the people of Judah, they went to the temple and served God and worshiped God and danced before God, and the choir that was there of in the days of David, we don't know later on exactly how it was, how many of them were there, but you know, there were still many, many, many of them, men and women singers, and God commanded them, as you read in Psalm 150 and many other places. He commanded Israel to come before him, the bride, the wife, you come before me, will you clap your hands, you know, lift up your hands, dance, you know, with your feet, and play music joyfully with timbrels, and he mentioned many of the instruments that God inspired David to make, to create. And God was throughout all that, and the whole entirety of the divine service was divine because God was inventing it, inspiring it, and planting it in the minds and the hearts of his servants, And with that in mind, they came and served him. Not with their own ideas and concepts and music or whatever it may be, and their own thoughts and their own opinions. God is not interested in that. So this is what we see here. And if you want more details, you know, go to those series called The Divine Service, Divine Worship. And so Miriam sang with them, and all of Israel, that is the women here now, they too are prophesying. Verse 22, and Moses led Israel onward from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And sure enough, you know, the children of Israel go back to their old ways. And they went 3 days, just 3 days, into the wilderness. And for 3 days, you know, more or less, they're happy. They're remembering what just happened. But how long did it last? So they go 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. Why is it they found no water? Because God made it sure that they go through areas where there is no water. Because now he's going to teach them lessons. Because they still need to learn lessons, you see. Trials don't come upon us for nothing. They have a reason. And they are because God is love and he's leading us from, you know, a palm tree to another palm tree, and sometimes from a dry area to another dry area in between. And everything has a purpose. And we should always be thankful and filled with gratitude toward God when we have and when we don't have. Because we understand when we don't have, God gives us other things that are more important, so we continue to have the things that we need. He takes care always of our needs. And had the people of Israel just, you know, got on their knees and said, you know, God, we're thirsty, kids are thirsty, and would you please help us? And sure enough, from wherever they were standing, you know, bubbling water will come out of the ground. God is not limited by anything. And so it was out of love that he was chastening them and correcting them, because he loved them, not hated them. But they thought, well, God hates us. Moses hates us. And so they came to the wilderness and found no water. Verse 23, and they came to Marah. It became known as Marah, means bitterness. They called the place bitterness. And they could not drink of the waters of Marah, bitter water. For they were bitter. So God leads them to a bitter water. And they said, you know, in their own minds, what kind of a God is that? What kind of, you know, leader are you, Moses? They said, what's wrong with you? How can you do things like that to us? And they complain. Well, that's the way human beings are. Because we don't see the hand of the canteen. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Well, no, that's not that. There's nothing wrong with asking what are we going to drink. But they were murmuring. So it was not just what shall we drink. They were saying many other things with the wrong attitude. And he cried unto the Lord. You know, what else could he do? And the Lord showed him a tree. And he cast it into the waters. And the waters were made sweet. So just because we come to a trial doesn't mean that God cannot turn around and make that trial, which to begin with, he led us into, caused it, allowed it, whichever it may be, he's orchestrating it. You know, sometimes we like to apologize for God. Well, God didn't do it, he just allowed it. If he allows it, he's doing it. Either personally or through somebody else. He's doing it. He's orchestrating it. Well, we shouldn't play this kind of games, you know, thinking that, well, God didn't do it, he just allowed it, therefore, you know, you cannot blame God for it, no? You can always blame him, you know, quote-unquote blame him, because he's the one orchestrating everything. That's what he said, I bring good and I bring evil. This was evil. Bitter water, to come to a bitter water, and everybody drinks, and it's bitter and they cannot drink it, to them that was evil. That's what it means, I create evil. But because they were disobedient, that it was bitter. You see? And then God wanted to show them, you obey me all the way, trust in me, and doesn't make any difference what it is. I'm going to make it sweet. And he did. And so he did not just, you know, just say poof, and there it is, sweet water. No, he said, well, you got to do something about it yourself. And he told Moses, you take a tree. He showed him a tree, you know, a stick probably, or a tree, whatever, you know, just chopped a little bit of it, and he threw it into the water. And the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinances. That is an ordinance. So here it is, a law of God. And some people don't think about it as a law of God, but it is a law. It's a part of the law that we should never forget. And there he proved them. And he said, if you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, that's a statute. If you do, that's a law. In other words, that's a teaching. And you will give ear to his commandments. And that was their problem. They were not. And keep all his statutes. And this is one of them. If you do that, I will put none of the diseases upon you, which I have put upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that heals you. You see, the water that they came to was water that people did not take care of, probably, and they dumped all kind of things into it and created, you know, algae and bacteria and all kind of things like that. People were drinking, getting sick to the stomach, you see. And so that's why he's mentioning this in reference. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense, you know, to talk about sickness and disease when it comes to the water, if that, there was no link there. So that's what he's telling them. If you're going to obey me, the water that you drink in life, whichever it may be, the water that we drink in life is going to be sweet water that will bring you health and not destruction. But if we don't obey God, the water that we drink in life, you know, spiritually speaking, whichever it may be, is going to make us sick, spiritually and physically. And that's in essence what God is telling us. This is one of His laws, a law that must be obeyed. You see, the faith is not just something that you believe, as you would read later on. Those who obey the faith, as Peter would put it and others, the faith must be obeyed. The gospel must be obeyed, not just believed. The faith of God is something you obey, not just believe. You see? A lot of people believe, well, the devil believes in God, he believes in Jesus Christ, he believes in the plan of salvation, he believes in all the doctrines of God, he knows they're all true, so what? You see? Faith is no, you know, of no value whatsoever if we do nothing about it, if we're not obedient. So a lot of people think that, you know, faith is good enough, you know? Man is going to be saved by faith alone. Well, if man is going to be, you know, saved by faith alone, then the devil has made it. And all his demons. And all the evil doers on the face of the earth. They can all have faith. You know, believe all these things. A lot of people believe in God, but they don't obey Him. What value is it in there? That's what God tells them. This is a law. If you obey me, if you walk in my statutes and judgments, I will make sure that the water that you drink in life is sweet. Your wife is going to be sweet. Your boss is going to be sweet. Your children are going to be sweet. People around you are going to be sweet. Life is going to be sweet. You know, generally speaking. And what is not going to be sweet is when you are disobedient to God and God needs to teach you a lesson. So we have a choice of either drinking from the fountain of God or the fountain of the devil. Or later on, as Paul would say, we don't drink from the cup of demons or devils and the cup of the Lord. You see, you either drink from the cup of the Lord, the water of the Lord, that is sweet, or if you drink from the wrong one, you know, life is not going to be sweet for you. And we all learn that, you know, all the sufferings and afflictions that came upon humanity is not because they were sweet people. You see, it's because they were not. And so, that happens with us too. And other times, you know, when God brings those kind of things upon us, it's not because we're rebels against God. At times, it's going to allow us to have a little taste of that, so that we can learn to serve Him even more so, with all of our being and heart. You see? But when we are totally, totally, wholly given to Him, you see, then there is no need for these things. They become, you know, of no consequence. And that's what He's saying here. That's a statute. That's a law. All these diseases that came upon Egypt, because they were not obedient to God, they were not, you know, obeying the laws of hygiene, they were not obeying the laws of clean and unclean food, they were not obeying the law of clean and unclean thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, passions, and all that. And so they were sick in so many ways. And so are many of us. And so that's what God is trying to teach us. We should not be that kind of people. And so verse 26, at the end, he says, if you are going to be that kind of people that obey my commandments and statutes, all my teachings, which I have, and then I'm not going to bring all those diseases which I put it upon the Egyptians. You see, after all, He's the one that created the germs and the viruses and all the other things. And He creates all those processes, and by the very law that He put into motion, where oftentimes does not even have to do anything personally, already did it by that very thing. We break a law, you know, the law exacts a penalty. And so He caused a lot of those diseases to come upon them, and Israel suffered, as long as they were in Egypt, all the same diseases. And God says, I will heal you if you walk, you know, in righteousness and not in sin. So people have said that sin, you know, the law is done away with, you know, I'm not interested in studying the law, we just live by faith, by grace and all that. And, you know, obviously you're talking to a very, very sick person. And unfortunately there are too many in our midst, to one degree or the other, who have, you know, different aspects of sicknesses and diseases of the spirit. When the thing, you know, law of God, you know, this or that, the other thing, I don't need to do it. I just have to obey just the Ten Commandments, or just be good and be nice, and so forth. And that's the problem always, unfortunately, with the people of God from the beginning of time until this day. Not everybody among the people of God is a genuine, wholehearted, obedient servant of God, as we should be. As a matter of fact, all of us are, you know, to one degree or the other, are committing iniquity, and we have to strive harder and harder and harder until we get to the point where God totally purged from us everything of Satan, and then we're whole. And so he said, you know, if you'll be obedient to me, I will remove all those diseases that I placed upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that heals you. In other words, I am Jehovah Rofecha. Rofecha means your physician. And from the word Rofe comes to heal, and the word for medicine in Hebrew is Refuah, and the word for the doctor in Hebrew is Rofe, which means a healer, you see. And true healing comes only by obedience to the laws of God. Even the physicians understand that. They cannot heal. You know, the body is the one that they work with, and the things that they give us is in terms of causing certain processes in the body to function in a certain way that healing would occur. They themselves, now they cannot heal. And they're not healers. And God is the one that does it. And the body that He created and the laws that He created and put in motion, they're the ones that do the healing. It's all from God. And so one of the names of God is the Eternal that heals you. You see, in English, that's how you say it. In Hebrew, you say Yehovah Rofecha. You see, the Eternal, your healer. So what is the name of God? Your physician, your healer. And that was one of the roles of Jesus Christ, the great physician, the healer, because we're sick and we need a physician. And so they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water. So now they had bitter water, which you turn into sweet. And now they're learning a lesson, and they're becoming a little bit more obedient, you know, like little children. You spank them, become a little bit more obedient, at least for a few minutes. After that, they are at it again. And so they are the set of a little obedience here. And so God brings them to an area where there are palm trees and springs of water. And 70 palm trees, and then camp there by the waters. Obviously, palm trees are not going to feed a whole nation, but it was an area where there is a lot of water, and those palm trees, and who knows what other things were there. And that, in essence, was a sign from God that He was pleased with their attitude in the moment. And so He led them to that. In chapter 16, we read in verse 1, and they took the journey from Elim, and Elim, that was the name of the place. El means God, deity, Elim, plural, Elim. So the place of that, that place was called Elim because people were worshipping deities in that place, and so they called it the place of the deities, the place of Elohim, or Elim. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel, and it's not children, I don't know whether to translate that to children, you know, the translation here is just using the King James, they're not children. It says sons. In Hebrew, always says sons. It doesn't say children. There's a difference between children and sons. A son can be either a little one or an old one. Children are just children. And so it's a wrong translation to say the children of Israel. It should be the sons of Israel. Bnei Israel. They came into the wilderness of Sin. And no relationship to the English word Sin. That was the name of the place, and as a matter of fact, that's the name of a land called China, Sin. And many of the children of Israel that did not go west into northwest Europe and other places, they went east instead, and they went into territories that the ancient Chinese Empire used to control. And biblically, it's still called Sin to this very day. And the prophet Isaiah, you read that, that when God brings back His people Israel, one of the places He's going to bring them from is the land of Sinim, the land of the Chinese. In other words, and of course they're not necessarily in China proper itself, but on the northern border of it, it was known in the ancient times, the children of Israel, that they were taken to captivity, especially the 10 tribes, were taken to those areas there, in the areas of the Persians and the Medes. Later on they spread, and they had their own territory, their own empire that spread all the way to northern China. And many people in northern China, they are different than the others. They're taller people, and their features are a little bit different than the regular Chinese. And that's because of the mixture that happened there between the children of Israel and those people up there. And so you find this northern Chinese are tall people, and they have Israelite blood in them. And also they have many others remain more pure, and still know to this very day their identity, even by tribe, tribe of Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher, and they're all in those territories up there in the states, republics that are called, you know, Stan at the end, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, you know, Kurdistan. There are so many stans there, many states, republics. A lot of children of Israel are there. Well, anyway, this is the word for it, sin. And so they took the journey from Elim, and they went to the, ended up in the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai or Sinai. So you see here Sin, Sinai, it's all the same, later on, Chinese people. And that's where the name came from, Sin. And on the 15th day of the second month, after their departing out of the land of Egypt, so here it is, a whole month that took them to get to this point, because obviously it's a whole nation, they're moving very slowly, and so it took them a whole month to get to this point. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel, again, after, you know, the miracle that God performed for them, they totally forgot about all that, just like as they always did before and do after and do to this very day. And the whole congregation, not just some of them, but the whole congregation of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron. Now, Aaron gets also into the acts of the murmur against him, because both of them are leaders and deal with the people. So they've got two now to pick on. And obviously, when you do that against the leaders of God that God is using, you're in essence murmuring against God himself. And verse 3, and the children of Israel said unto them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. So they're accusing God, because they know that God is the one that brought them out, so they're accusing God. You know, why do you even bring us out of the land of Egypt? You know, life was good there. Slavery was nice. That's what happens to people when God brings them out of captivity. And then they have a few trials here and there, and they want to go back to the old way. They all vomit. They feel comfortable there. And so that's what God says here. In essence, that's what his people were doing. They're complaining against him, against Moses, against Aaron, against what he had done to them, bringing them out of Egypt. They said, why did he do that? When we said by the flesh pots, that's all they can remember, when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. So they're accusing God and Moses. Verse 4, then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will cause to rain bread from heaven for you. Well, God is not limited with anything. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. In other words, this whole thing was a question of a test of faith. God wanted to know. He's dealing with Israel. He's bringing them out of slavery, out of their nature and character that they have developed there, their idol worship, where their trust was in something they could see, and they would pray to those idols. And they did not pray to an indivisible God. You see, he was an invisible God to them, and so they did not have a relationship with him. So now he's building a relationship with them through all these things that he's doing for them, all the signs and wonders and miracles, and they are just like babes. But they were not willing to learn. A lot of people that you tell them certain things, I'll do such and such, you know, thing for you, and they believe in you, they put your trust in you, because you know you come through and you do it in two or three times and four times and that's it, and after that they have no problem. And so if you tell them another time that you'll do this and that, they believe you and all that, because you are a person, they see you see, and human beings generally function like that. But when they have a God, a divine being that they cannot talk to, they cannot see his face, you know, this is a very unusual situation for people. And still, though he did all these signs and wonders and miracles, Moses they could see, Aaron they could see, and so whenever they had a problem, they would complain to them, not to God, generally speaking. But not having a relationship with God himself, that's exactly what they were doing. And so God is trying to build in them this habit of faith. Just like they trust human beings, just like they trust the parents or friends or whatever it may be, just like they put the trust in deities that could not really do much for them, is all superstitious. They should put their trust in a real God, in a divine being. And so this trial is not for just, well, it just happened, you know, it just took them over there. No, everything is calculated. Every step here is calculated along the way. And so it is with us, and though we don't realize it, but everything that happens in our lives, when God is in our life, and we put Him in our life, and we walk with Him, all those things are going to happen so God can build in us His very nature, His very mind and character, you know, the very nature of His Son. And so as we study these things, we should not study them just on an intellectual basis and say, well, that's very interesting, but apply them in our own life and whatever situation we go through and develop that eyesight by faith, realizing that God is watching, He's active, He's doing what He needs to do. Jesus Christ is, His holy angels that He sets over us are, and so we walk with Him. And so this is what He tells the people, but they are not, unfortunately, for 40 years, they are not interested in even sitting down to ponder this and learn from that and settle the matter once and for all. So God is saying, I'm doing all these things because I want to prove them, to see whether they are going to walk in My law or not. In verse 5, and it shall come to pass on the sixth day that they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. Obviously, people are going to ask, oh, what do you mean about 6 days? Or what about the seventh day? Well, people generally knew that it was a Sabbath day. Jacob kept the Sabbath. Jacob kept the law of God and holy days also. That knowledge was in Israel, even though they were in that period of slavery, but the knowledge was still there. And many people were keeping the Sabbath, even though they were not allowed by the Pharaoh. But the older ones could do it. The younger ones could do it. You see, so it was not that it was totally gone. Nobody remembered. Nobody knew what it meant. Knowledge was there, at least to a degree. And so when Moses tells them that, you know, they obviously understand that it is the Sabbath, and obviously there is more instruction here that is not even recorded about the Sabbath. And so this is what he tells them in verse 6, and Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, at even, then you shall know the Lord has brought you out from the land of Egypt. See, all this time that he had done all the signs and wonders and miracles were not good enough for them. So every time they have to say the same thing. So you will know. And in the morning, then you shall see the glory of the Lord, for that he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. This is what he reminded them. That when you complain, it's not us. We do not perform signs, wonders, and miracles. We didn't bring you out of Egypt. You see, it's God who is doing all that. So when you complain directly to him. And you think that you are complaining to men. And you complain against him. And you speak against him. And this is what he tells them. And obviously, they unfortunately never learn the lesson. And so he says, your murmuring is against the Lord. And what are we that you murmur against us? Yeah, we're just flesh and blood. And Moses said, this shall be. Then the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord heard your murmurings, which you murmur against Him. And what we are. Now this is the most common thing to human beings, to human nature. Things don't go well, whatever it may be. We realize some people are not doing their job properly, or we think they don't, because we don't understand all the facts. And the first thing we do, we complain. And sometimes we don't realize, if God is in the process of doing all these things, our complaint is really against Him. We are in essence saying that He doesn't know what He's doing. And a lot of people do it without even realizing it in life, about so many things. If God is the one in our life, and we put Him in our life, and we put our trust in Him, and we let God live His life in us, and Jesus Christ being formed in us, then obviously many things that happen to us in our life are going to be from Him. And since they are from Him, why do we find ourselves yet complaining about this and about that and about everything else? And we don't even realize against whom we are complaining. You know, we have to learn all these things. As we read these words about our forefathers, they had the same nature that we do. And that's what Paul admonished us, that when you read all these matters, just remember that in reality, whatever you do it as unto the Lord, whether you realize it or not. Anyway, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.